This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In Bardstown, a police officer called an interrogation room and told his brother. We just did that story yesterday in this series. The prime suspect to stop talking. Don't talk to them. In Delphi, a story before that, a tip that could have identified the killer sat misfiled in a box for 5 years. In Boulder, a crime scene was handed to a department that had never worked a murder and refused every offer of help. Each of those cases lost something that can never be recovered: time, testimony, forensic integrity. But the case I'm about to tell you lost something even more fundamental. It lost every single piece of physical evidence. The carpet, the blood, the weapon, the car, all of it gone. And his father spent 27 years fighting a system that had the confession, had the proof, and let all of it walk out the door. If you're following the Nancy Guthrie case, the evidence that's been collected in that investigation is the ballgame. The DNA, the camera footage, the physical materials from inside the home. Some of those things they don't have. Say it doesn't exist. Did it? Was it lost? Did it ever exist? This case is a warning about what happens when the chain of custody breaks and why it can never rebuild once it does. And I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through this. Somewhere in the evidence chain of the Hollywood Police Department, a car disappeared. Not a stolen car, not an abandoned car. A 1971 white Cadillac sedan DeVille belonging to a convicted serial killer who had confessed twice to the abduction and murder of a six-year-old boy. Inside that car, investigators had found blood on the front and rear floorboards. They had removed carpet samples. They had documented a machete that the owner identified as the weapon he used to... And all of it, the carpet, the blood, the machete, evidence, and eventually the car itself, somehow vanished from police custody. Not destroyed intentionally, not suppressed, just gone. Lost by the very people whose job it was to protect it. How do you lose a car? Yeah, I don't know. We're going to get into it. A confessed killer walked free of this particular crime, not because he was innocent. By virtually all accounts, he wasn't. But because the people responsible for the evidence couldn't keep track of it, and a family spent 27 years waiting for an answer, the system lost the ability to deliver. Evidence is a chain. Every person who touches it either preserves it or compromises it. There is no middle ground. In the Nancy Guthrie investigation, the evidence recovered in the early hours, supposed DNA from inside the home, the doorbell camera footage, the physical items left behind by the suspect, represents the case's best chance at resolution. The question that should haunt every person involved in that investigation is whether the people handling that evidence in the very first moment had the training and the infrastructure to protect it. Because in Hollywood, Florida, in 1981, the evidence existed, the confession existed, the physical proof existed, and the department lost every piece, every single one. July 27th, 1981. Reveille Walsh takes her six-year-old son, Adam, to a Sears department store at a shopping mall in Hollywood, Florida. It's a routine errand. She needs to look at a lamp that's on sale. She leaves Adam at a kiosk in the toy department where a group of boys are playing an Atari display. She walks to the lamp section, handles her business, and comes back a few minutes later, and Adam is gone. All the boys are gone. Here's what happened in those minutes. A scuffle broke out at the kiosk. Kids arguing over whose turn it was. A Sears security guard came over, told the boys to leave, and asked if their parents were in the store. The older boy said no. Adam, who's six, shy by his parents' account, apparently didn't speak up. The guard sent the entire group out through the west entrance of the store. The older boys scattered, and Adam was left standing alone outside a door he didn't recognize. In a section of the parking lot his mother didn't know he was in. He didn't know how to get back inside. He was, after all, six. A drifter named Otis Tootle was in the area. Tootle was a career criminal, arsonist, serial killer, the traveling companion of Henry Lee Lucas, a man whose life was a catalog of violence and depravity. Witnesses would later place Tootle in the Hollywood area in the days surrounding Adam's disappearance. Tootle himself would later describe luring Adam to his white Cadillac with promises of toys and candy, then driving north on the Florida Turnpike, with the boy in the back seat. 2 weeks passed. Rave and John Walsh lived in a nightmare of waiting for searches, of police activity that felt chaotic and directionless from the very beginning. John Walsh would later describe the department's response as exactly that: chaotic, disorganized, a tiny agency that had never managed to search anywhere near this size. Then on August 10th, fishermen found Adam's severed head in a drainage canal near Vero Beach, roughly 120 miles from Hollywood, Florida. His body has never been recovered. The cause of death was determined to be homicide. Adam was identified by his dental records. He was 6 years old. The Hollywood Police Department was small. It handled the crimes that a small South Florida city generates: burglaries, assaults, the normal churn. It had never handled anything like the abduction and murder of a child. The initial response reflected that. Walsh himself wrote about it years later. The sense from the very first hours that mistakes were being made, that things were disorganized, that nobody was quite sure who was running the operation or what the plan was. But the department pushed forward, and in October of 1983, they got what should have been the break that closed the case. Otis Tootle, sitting in a Jacksonville jail on arson charges, told Hollywood police he had kidnapped and taken the life of Adam Walsh. He described the abduction. He described driving with Adam on the turnpike. He described killing him. And he described using a machete in 4 or 5 strikes. The medical examiner's findings were consistent with that description. Tootle had details. He had knowledge. He had a confession. And then the Hollywood Police Department proceeded to lose everything that could have put him in a courtroom. The carpet from Tool's Cadillac, the carpet with blood on it, the carpet that detective would decades later describe as bearing the impression of a child's face in blood transfer, was removed from the car and placed into evidence. And at some point, it was transferred to the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. At some point after that, it was misplaced, gone. At the time, DNA testing didn't exist, but blood type testing did. And it was never conducted before the carpet disappeared. When DNA technology later became available, the carpet that could have confirmed or excluded Adam's blood in that car no longer existed to test. The machete, Tootle identified as the actual weapon, had blood on it. Investigators collected it, but they never lifted the blood, never ran blood type analysis, never preserved the biological evidence in any way that would allow future testing. The blood was documented and then effectively abandoned on the blade. The car itself, the 1971 white Cadillac, the vehicle Tootle described using in the abduction, the moving crime scene that contained blood evidence on multiple surfaces, disappeared from police custody entirely. Not released to a junkyard, not destroyed in a fire, just gone. Nobody could account for where it went. And photographs taken during the original evidence collection, photographs of the carpet, the machete, the interior of the car, were never developed. They sat in the case file for over two decades, unseen, until retired Miami Beach homicide detective named Joe Matthews was brought in to re-examine the case in 2006, 25 years after the murder. Matthews found the underdeveloped photos in the file. When he had them processed, one of the images showed a blood transfer impression on the carpet behind the driver's seat, an impression that Matthews described as the image of a young child's face. Nobody had ever seen it because nobody had ever developed the photos. Without the physical evidence, Toole recanted his confession, then confessed again, then recanted again. His confessions, though detailed, were complicated by the fact that he and his partner, Henry Lee Lucas, had confessed to hundreds of murders, many of which they demonstrably did not commit. Toole was a known unreliable confessor, and without corroborating physical evidence, prosecutors couldn't charge him. He was never indicted for Adam Walsh's murder. He died in prison in 1996 at the age of 49, serving life sentences for other crimes. His niece reportedly told John Walsh that Toole made a deathbed confession. It didn't matter legally. The evidence that could have held him accountable was gone. John Walsh ended up channeling his devastation into something extraordinary. You may recognize his name. He became the most visible victims advocate in the country. He's probably the reason we're doing this show today. He hosted America's Most Wanted, put that on the map, put true crime into the lexicon of every American household, which has directly contributed to the capture of over 1,000 fugitives. He pushed Congress to pass the Missing Children's Act of 1982, mandating that the FBI include missing children in its national database. He co-founded what became the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He fought for the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, signed into law in 2006. The entire infrastructure that exists in this country to find missing children, the Amber Alerts, the faces on milk cartons, the school fingerprinting programs, the coordinated response systems, was built in large part because one father refused to let his son's murder mean nothing. And he chose to hold power accountable. When they said, we're doing everything we can, we got it all. No, you're not. In 2008, 27 years after Adam's murder, a new Hollywood police chief named Chadwick Wagner held a press conference. He officially closed the case. He named Otis Toole as Adam Walsh's killer, and he apologized publicly and formally for the department's failures. Our agency has devoted an inordinate amount of time seeking leads to other potential perpetrators rather than emphasizing Otis Toole as our primary suspect, Wagner said. John Walsh accepted the closure. This is not to look back and point fingers, he said, but it is to let it rest. 27 years. That's how long a family waited for answers that the system had the ability to deliver in 1983. If the people handling the evidence had been equipped for the responsibility. The confession was there. The physical proof was there. And a department that had never faced anything like this let every single piece of it walk away. The Nancy Guthrie case is active. The evidence that's been collected, the DNA from inside the home, the footage, the physical materials left behind by whoever entered that house, is either going to solve this case or it isn't. And the determining factor won't be how clever the suspect was or how careful the crime was. It will be whether the people who touched that evidence in the first hours, the first days, the first weeks, handled it with the care it demanded. The Adam Walsh case is what happens when they don't. It's the cautionary tale for every active investigation in America. And it should be required reading for every person who touches evidence in the Guthrie case or any other. Adam Walsh was 6 years old. He was a gap-tooth, smile, little kid who had a baseball bat and freckles and liked video games. Atari. He was left alone outside a department store by a security guard who didn't ask the right questions. And he was taken by a man who shouldn't have been free. Adam Walsh should be older than me today. His father turned that grief into a national movement that has saved more children than we will ever be able to count. But Adam himself never got justice, not real justice, not a trial, not conviction, not accountability, because the people entrusted with the evidence that could have delivered it weren't ready for what was in their hands. And by the time anyone recognized the scope of what they'd lost, it was 27 years too late. Some cases change the system after the system fails. Adam Walsh's case did, profoundly. But the system that failed him still exists in departments across this country. Small agencies, understaffed evidence rooms, personnel without specialized training, handling materials they don't fully understand the importance of. The rules have improved. The technology has improved. The question is whether the people in the room have improved enough. Because the lesson of Adam Walsh isn't just about the past, it's about right now. It's about every case that's currently open in every jurisdiction where someone is holding evidence they may not fully appreciate, and the family counting on that evidence has no idea how fragile the chain really is. It's been part four here of Beyond Nancy, exposing incompetent investigations. And the final case in our series takes everything we've talked about, the ego, the overwhelm, the sabotage, the lost evidence, and strips it down to its most basic form. A family that finds their own son's body in an area police claim they already searched. A coroner with a history of misconduct who rules the death undetermined. And a community of silence that hasn't broken in over two decades. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. That's coming up next. I'm going to drop it tomorrow, if you're listening to this the day we're dropping this, or just look on our feed and that's where you will find it. Look forward to your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue it there. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.